Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. This is Larry Mishkin welcoming you to another episode of our podcast. My normal co-host, Jim Marty, is out today celebrating Thanksgiving with family. So a shout out to Jim. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving. And you've worked a little cannabis into the meal with some Grateful Dead music in the background, and we'll hear all about it next week. So I will miss Jim today, but I am joined, I can happily say, by Rob Hunt. Rob is a multi-appearance guest on our show and was kind enough to step in on rather short notice to help us out and fill in for Jim today. Rob, how are you?
I'm great, Larry. Thanks. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. And as I'm sitting here in what's not so lovely this time of year, Illinois, we're cold, we're rainy, and not at all Thanksgiving weather. What's it like where you are?
Well, Southern California is Southern California, so 70 degrees and sunny, and I'll probably go for a mountain bike ride or a hike after this podcast and get out and try to enjoy a little bit of the weather before it gets too cold or dark.
Good for you out there. Very nice. I'm glad you could join us today. We will, of course, get to some Grateful Dead in a moment because it's not worthwhile having Rob Hunt on the show if we don't talk Grateful Dead in excess. However, we're going to start with a little bit of marijuana talk. And I'm going to give everyone a quick update on what's going on in Illinois. We've been following the scene here for a while. It's been generally frustrating and it's gotten worse. And an announcement just came out yesterday on the dispensary level that the state of Illinois is no longer going to be negotiating with any of the parties, and it's going to step back and it's going to let the court process play itself out. And the estimate is that with the parties that are currently involved and the claims that are swirling back and forth, even with expedited work, we're probably looking at nothing earlier than April before we get some sort of a judicial ruling. And while we'd all like to think that that would then trigger the process to go forward and finalize who gets the licenses, all of us lawyers know that the real money is made on appeal. And so I have no confidence that the litigation coming to a close will actually be the end. I should say the trial work will be the end of the litigation. So we'll see. But people who are expecting to find out on April 1st of 2020 whether or not all the time and money they put into their applications had paid off for them are now being told that it'll be at least 1 year from that date, if we're lucky, before they will find out anything. And they may not even know by then. To compound the problem, the state seems to be signaling that it will delay announcements of the craft, grow, and processing licenses until after it announces the dispensary licenses, because since they were all scored on the same system with the same scoring company, KPMG, they want to see what the court has to say about it on the dispensary level before they are convinced as to whether or not they're clear on the craft, grow, and processing level. However, there is pending litigation from the newly formed Craft Growers Association in federal court trying to get an order entered to compel the state to announce the winners of the craft grow and not to go forward. And actually, Rob, this is a topic that you and I have discussed before, and you know, it might be interesting to talk about here for a minute, because I happen to have clients on both sides of this divide, especially on the dispensary level, where I have one who qualified for the tiebreaker with a perfect score and a few others who didn't. And quite frankly, I think they should have had perfect scores too. So I understand their frustration, and I understand their desire to get behind the litigation that's going to hopefully give them a chance to still be part of the game. You know, the problem, of course, is that it delays the rollout of this next phase of the Illinois program out for such a long time that I wonder, you know, if the real losers aren't, you know, the citizens of Illinois and the people who had come to this state to make use of the program.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that at all. When you think about the implications of keeping an illicit market alive, the longer litigation happens, you know, one of two things happens as a result. One, the companies that actually have licenses already just become infinitely stronger during that period, and the illicit market is just artificially kept alive. And so as I've watched states that have tried to say, we're going to take a very nuanced and measured approach to how we open up legalization in our state, what they fail to realize is that, you know, by doing so and not allowing free market capitalism just to kind of work its way through the way a lot of the West Coast states have, there's all sorts of other issues that happen. And so I've always joked about it with potential clients and with other people that are looking at, you know, the application process. And they say, okay, once a law is passed, you know, what's the next, you know, part of the process? And I say, well, the state's got to figure out the rulemaking. Then at that point, they open up the RFP process to start taking documents in for the applications. Then it's, you know, a period of time to accept the applications and then a period of time to grade them. and then comes 2 years of litigation. And they always look at me cross-eyed when I say that. And I'm not trying to be cynical. If you're dealing with a very contested, limited license state like in Illinois or in New York or a lot of the other East Coast states, expect that litigation is part of this process, because anyone that's dropped $500,000 into an application that doesn't receive one and was very close to receiving one is going to have a perception of being wronged in the process. And all that does is convince them that they need to file suit and slow down the process. Again, to your point, it's the citizens and those that want to access the cannabis program that end up losing. And if they just made it more accessible, like let's say Maryland, for instance, or Nevada, where they put out enough licenses out there, then most people that wanted one that were qualified were able to get one. It's only in the states where it's so few that you can't.
You're right. Oklahoma, for instance, I have a couple of clients who have expressed some interest in the Oklahoma market where everybody gets in. And one of the things I was really kind of surprised to see was that the commercial price in Oklahoma has not dropped as precipitously as I thought it might, given the number of dispensaries and producers that are out there, but it seems like they've been able to maintain at least a reasonable price out there. And, that would certainly weigh heavy in favor of, that model that you're talking about, which is, and that's what they do here for hemp in Illinois. It's very interesting, right? Anyone who wants a hemp license, you can go online, you can get one in about 20 minutes, as long as you have a piece of property and you don't have a disqualifying conviction in your background, you're in, and then you want to go start growing hemp or processing hemp, have at it. And it seems to me that that would also be the best way, because if you have people who are really going to throw a lot of money into it, great. Let's have a couple of big high rollers in the industry. You'll probably get a few who will come in on the lower level. And, somewhere along the way, it'll balance itself out. And really, you're right. It is free market capitalism at that point. But more importantly, what it does is it eliminates all of this litigation. And as a guy who made his living doing litigation for 30 years, I have to say that, the lesson I've learned is that nobody comes out of litigation happy. It takes forever. The attorneys get paid money, but the clients aren't happy and bitch at them. The attorneys bitch about the judges. The judges don't care. And, it's never a positive experience for anyone. And, while I empathize with all of those people, especially those here in Illinois, because I think some of their arguments are legit. I think there were some problems with the scoring and the grading. But, the solution that's being proposed is basically just to let everybody in. And if you let everybody into the tiebreaker, then my argument is, why did we have to do all of this other work? Why didn't we just have a tiebreaker? Here's my name, put me in the tiebreaker. Instead of having people spend all of this money to try to create a competitive application that apparently now it becomes irrelevant.
Yeah, no, it's certainly a problem. And you'd think that when you look at the states that have had hyper successful programs, that the other states would follow suit. And Colorado being a prime example of a group that really came out of the gate, thought about this thing, did it right. They got caught flat footed when they first passed the laws back in 2008. But by 2011 or so, they'd gotten it largely correct. And as you went into adult use, they got it correct again. And it was, we're not going to restrict the ability of people to open. But once you open, then you better be a good operator. If you're not a good operator, then the guy next door is probably going to clean your clock. And if he does, you're probably out of business. So it was incumbent upon the people that opened the stores or opened their cultivations to be good performers. And if they knew how to run a business, then they're going to be just fine. If you look at the number of dispensaries in Colorado back in 2010 or 11, there's only half as many today. And that's because the cream rose to the top. And it's very, very simple that way. Ultimately, you're going to have equilibrium in a market. And that's going to happen in any market. Anytime you've got an underserviced market, the only thing you're doing is keeping an illicit market alive. And the only other thing you're doing is creating behemoths of businesses, which is what the intention was, initially to not create, which is, we don't want, big business cannabis. We want to make sure that this is something that initially was, for medical patients and then ultimately for adult use was going to be something that was accessible to everyone. And I don't think anyone wanted to create the Budweisers or the Diageos of the world in the cannabis industry. And that's, that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, that's what's happening here in Illinois, for instance. We had a couple, and I give these guys credit. I mean, they're great businessmen. They came out of the box, and starting in a state like Illinois with a very restricted medical program that was going nowhere, they created these huge multi-state operations, and Cresco and GTI and Revolution and, PharmaCann and a few of these have really, come onto the national scene in a big way and done a really good job for themselves. But one of the things that they are doing is, I predict it's just a matter of time before they pretty much own the Illinois market. And, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I guess kind of remains to be seen. But I really like the idea of there being a competitive market that allows, for lack of a better way of saying it, the mom and pop shop in, you know, and give people who really are, you know, true cannabis fans an opportunity, you know, to participate in the market.
Yeah. And look, I think we're both smart enough to realize that ultimately there's going to be a consolidation across the entire market. And, you know, it's going to happen post federal legalization. But in the meantime, you know, it should allow, you know, some groups to come out. And I always look at telecom in the 90s where everyone was opening, you know, sort of like cell phone towers before the consolidation hit. And you ended up with your Verizons and T-Mobiles and a couple other winners. But initially, there was, you know, thousands and thousands of cell operators that that then watched consolidation. And there's a lot of people in that process that did very well for themselves by entering that market and being good at it. And, you know, to your point, in Illinois, if you look at the ruling that came down from the appellate court in New Jersey yesterday, you know, it's the first time in a while we've gotten some movement in New Jersey, which was, you know, the results for the most recent wave of medical applications came out, you know, months ago and then immediately entered a stage of litigation. And the appellate court yesterday came out and said, you know, there isn't enough reason to stop some of the other applicants that were denied licenses from being denied. So, you know, what's going to happen, we're not sure, but it's certainly going to open up the market a little bit. But if you look at this period of latency where nothing has happened between the time that they should have announced the winners and the time that these guys should have been able to open their doors, since then, we've watched adult use legalization in New Jersey pass, which means that the next round of applications for adult use is going to start relatively soon. So all these people that felt wronged by the process and felt like it wasn't fair that they lost, had they just bided their time and waited until the inevitability of legalization under Governor Murphy, they would have gotten another bite at this apple anyway. And quite honestly, at a more lucrative style license, being an adult use license rather than a medical license. So really, where is the perceived harm? You know, where is it they couldn't have waited for 6 months instead of holding the entire industry back in favor of waiting it out until the next wave opened up? And that's, you know, it, hopefully, you know, states like New York and Pennsylvania, as they go into their process, and they will hopefully very soon, are going to look at what happened in New Jersey and say, okay, we need to make this a bit less restrictive than it has been in favor of having more applicants and more winners and more licenses so that we're just not mired in litigation for the foreseeable future.
Well, I think that's great, and you're absolutely right about that. And you know what I imagine, and I, you know, I don't mean this in a negative way, but it's kind of hard to imagine avoid is, you know, these big players here in Illinois, you know, kind of, you know, secretly toasting themselves with champagne, because by doing little or nothing, you know, their monopoly on the market is going to extend into the foreseeable future. And I mean, and the Illinois market is out of control right now. It you know, each month we beat the previous month in terms of sales and products sold and everything. And, you know, and good for these guys, you know, they carried the medical market, and I understand. But I think that ultimately, you said this also, how much more difficult is it for a craft grow to come on the scene, you know, to already compete against a full-scale grow, right? You can grow marijuana commercially in the state, but only on 5,000 square feet, and you have to compete against Cresco and GTI, who are growing on 100,000 square feet per facility, and they have multiple facilities. But now, in the adult-use market, by the time any of these other craft growers finally find out if they have licenses, you know, you have branding, you have people who have pretty much decided, I like Verano, I like Cresco, I like, you know, Arise, any of these, and they're all, you know, they're all good in their own way. But how does a late coming craft grow that's limited in what it can do hope to compete in a market after there's been so much lag time that the medical people have really, you know, sunk their roots into it?
No, absolutely.
We'll see. It's, you know, I would like everyone who would like to have a license to get one. I think that, you know, the way you discuss it is definitely the way to go. And hopefully we'll find out. Another thing that you and I had looked at talking about today, and ultimately I think we've come to the conclusion that it might be premature, is now that it looks at least like we have a final result and that Joe Biden is going to be our next president. And so for a lot of people in our industry, it's not too early to start wondering what impact that's going to have on the industry. And I think, as you pointed out, you know, while he's starting to name some of his cabinet, we still need to see who the rest of those people are going to be. We need to have an opportunity to go and explore what their positions are on this. I guess I would say that I feel better about its chances. But given the fact that a guy like Obama wasn't willing to touch it, I don't necessarily see it as a slam dunk with this administration.
I think that's right. You certainly saw Kamala Harris in her vice presidential debate say that, you know, decriminalization is certainly on the table. I think that there's, you know, going to be an expansion of the industry, but, you know, there has been, you know, even through the Trump administration, quite honestly, even through through George W., you know, before that. So it's not to say that Republicans being, you know, running the government from the executive branch are going to slow this thing down. The question is just when do we get to, you know, full tilt federal legalization. And I don't think that that Biden or Harris necessarily will make that move. And certainly I don't think it'll be the first thing that they touch. But what I will say is that we're going to know a lot more when we see who Biden names as his attorney general. And I can say with definitive certainty that that attorney general will certainly be more permissive than either Jeff Sessions or Bill Barr. You know, whether or not they're as relaxed as Eric Holder or Loretta Lynch, hard to say. But I would expect you're going to see a pretty permissive attorney general that when it comes to drug policy. The big question is what happens in Georgia on January 5th.
I was just going to say, right?
Yeah, at this point, it's really hard to tell. I mean, you're seeing a lot of people on the right that are saying they want to boycott this election because, you know, they feel the election results weren't trustworthy for the presidential election. At the same time, I think there's going to be a lot of Dems that feel like they just pulled out every stop they could to try to win in the presidential race, and they barely squeaked by. You know, Georgia's traditionally a very red state. It's looking pretty purple right now. But can they motivate, you know, and mobilize enough people to come back out and vote again for the Senate contest? Yeah, if you were to say handicap it, I'd say Mitch McConnell stays in power going into this next session. And if he does, then I think that most bills that are canvas related bills are still dead on arrival if they end up either on Lindsey Graham's desk or on Mike Crapo's desk or, you know, whoever it is that takes over judiciary or banking. I think it's going to be a slog, especially if the whole goal of a McConnell-led Senate is to prevent any legislation from moving forward under a Biden presidency.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that that's where people tend to lose sight of this is when we talk about what can the administration do. The administration can only do what it can get done in Congress. And while it's wonderful to, you know, if you're a liberal and so inclined to have Joe Biden in the White House, but as we saw under the Obama presidency, you know, for almost three quarters of his term, when you have a Senate that's opposed to you from the other party, it's already difficult enough. And then you add in a guy like Mitch McConnell, who, you know, has decided that, you know, that gives him, and I guess at some level it does, but, you know, really to kind of abuse that power and be very inclined not to pass measures along. And the reason why I think that's important is, you know, we always talk about, Jim and I like to talk about all the time, the fact that marijuana is one of those great subjects that's bipartisan and that, you know, Republicans and conservatives like to get high as much as liberals and Democrats. And, you know, we see wide bipartisan support around the country. That was reflected in all the marijuana measures that all passed by huge amounts. And that's a good thing. And so people might say, well, you know, but is Loeffler any more pro or anti-marijuana? But it's not really about their personal views. It's about whether or not Mitch McConnell remains head of the Senate. And if he does, then he is the gatekeeper. And I, you know, that would not give me great confidence. Well, we know the state bill has been up there, and the fair banking bill have both been passed with heavy bipartisan support in the House, and they've languished on McConnell's desk.
Well, hasn't even gotten to his desk. They've languished in committee.
In committee.
And
right.
So, you know, if it can't even get out of committee, if you don't get a committee vote, then McConnell doesn't have to do anything. He can say, he can punt and say, it never reached my desk, so it wasn't for me to opine. Right. So, I mean, there's three different layers where, you know, this thing can be shut down. And it's the committee, then it's, you know, the McConnell introducing it to the Senate floor, and then ultimately it's the president's desk. Right. I think that anything that reaches the president's desk under a Biden administration, if it's been passed in the House and the Senate, will get a signature.
Yes, I agree with that.
I just don't think you have any chance of reaching Biden's desk if McConnell takes the approach that he's taken, you know, not just during Obama's administration, but even during Trump's administration since the House flipped, where he said, you know, I'm the Grim Reaper and I'm where bills go to die. And so I'd expect that you're going to see any democratically sponsored bill that comes out of a very divided House at this point get to McConnell's desk and have him say, well, there isn't really a true mandate here. It's too close in the House at this point, you know. I'm not going to encourage anything being signed that's not, you know, fully bipartisan supported, which would come with a great deal of concessions on the Republican side. And I don't think they're in the mood to make concessions at this point.
No, I think you're right. So, okay, well, this is an interesting topic. And I suppose until we get the answers to some of our other questions, which way Georgia goes, who the attorney general is, that it's somewhat academic at this point, but there are a lot of interesting factors with this. And I would certainly suggest for those of you that are big fans or supporters of the cannabis industry, that would help motivate you to contribute to the Georgia campaigns and see if we can't get a Democratic controlled Senate, if for no other reason, to kind of open the spigot, if you will, on some of this marijuana legislation that even before we take it off of Schedule One, will still help the industry and provide for it in some really good ways.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to wrap it up, Larry, is that people need to understand that if you really want, federal legalization or federal change to progress, this vote in Georgia for cannabis is monumental, and that people really need to think about the implications of having a Senate that can pass things and can get things out of committee and get them to the president's desk. And if you really want to see cannabis legislation move forward, if you're out there in Georgia and you're listening to this, please do mobilize, because it makes a huge difference. This vote is the difference between the STATES Act and the Safe Banking Act passing, or never even getting a chance to see a vote.
Okay, so with that, let's turn over to a topic that hopefully all of our listeners can agree upon, and that is the Grateful Dead. And given that you and I are sitting here taping this, I know it won't be heard for a few days from now, but we're actually taping it the day before Thanksgiving. And it got me thinking, and I'd pass this thought along to you. We have the Grateful Dead playing shows on the 4th of July. We have the Grateful Dead playing shows on New Year's Eve. We have the Grateful Dead playing shows on the summer solstice and the spring solstice and on the Chinese New Year, and any good excuse they can ever find to have a concert, they always seem to find one. And it got me thinking about Thanksgiving, and I was really surprised when I did a very quick Google search to find that in all the years they only played one show on Thanksgiving in 1978. And on the one hand, I find that kind of strange, but on the other hand, maybe not. They like to be home with their families too.
Yeah, I thought about it, and you're right. I mean, I think of all the holidays I've actually seen the Dead play on, and a lot of the ones you mentioned, I've seen shows, whether it's July 4th, Chinese New Year, Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras, right.
But Thanksgiving is one that, I was thinking, I'm surprised they haven't played more, but then I thought about what Thanksgiving means and kind of like the family nature of Thanksgiving and how many people really do spend the entire day with their families. And I always thought that, the biggest night traditionally for bar sales is the night after Thanksgiving.
Right.
So you'd think that would be a night that the Dead would definitely play a lot. So, I'm curious to know whether the only reason that they never did it again is because ticket sales were low that night, or they just decided, let's just stick around California and hang out with our families rather than being on the road. Having said that, the year they played was a pretty hot show.
Right.
So we should look at it. There aren't too many times where you get a Shakedown Street after Space or get a dancing into Terrapin before drums.
Well, right. Maybe that's it, because as you read through a set list like this, I mean, Thanksgiving isn't necessarily a holiday that lends itself, to a whole, big number of songs that they might play. But as you look through the list, there's nothing that really jumps off the page and screams the holiday at you, except for the fact that, you're right, they do have some interesting song placement in this show. I love the fact that they're playing Samson and Delilah and it's not a Sunday night. I wonder what Bobby said leading into this one, right? It being Thanksgiving. I don't know.
That's really funny too. Yeah. Cause I don't know if everyone out there knows, but Samson was always a Sunday song, Samson Sundays and Saturday night was always on Saturday night.
Right. But I would love that, Bobby coming out in his goofy kind of way, it being Sunday, and then, they dive into it, but yeah, okay. Terrapin is kind of where it belongs, but dancing in the streets into Terrapin, that's just that little snippet I'd pay for price of admission alone.
I would too. Yeah.
And then into a play. But yeah, I have never seen, this is the first I've ever can recall seeing a Shakedown come out of the drums or Space or, whatever they were doing then. And that's pretty amazing. I like that. And then the play and reprise, which is always nice when they remember to do it. And around and around. I don't know about you, but when I first started seeing them in the early 80s and all through the 80s, Around and Around was never the closing tune. It was always the tune that would lead into Good Lovin', Sugar Magnolia, something like that. But then for a while they flipped back and it was the closer. And the thing about that is, for me, is even if I get a little frustrated with it, I find that if I go back and I look back in their history, I typically find, yeah, they used to do that before. This isn't so strange or whatever. It's just different than what I'm used to seeing. And I love Around and Around. I think it's a great song. And it doesn't get enough credit. But, you know, I always liked it played into, you know, a traditional set closer.
I agree. And around, because it's a Chuck Berry tune, you know, you always expect it to be kind of a scorcher the way Johnny B. Goode or Promised Land is.
Yep.
And it never really takes off. Yep. You know, it always feels like it's going to take off, but it never really, you know, has that the same upbeat excitement as the other ones. It's like a down tempo version of a Johnny B. Goode.
Right.
And so for that reason, like, it's a great song to play before the barn burner at the end, but it never really gets it done for closing a set the way like a Sugar Maggs does, or the way a Johnny B. Goode would.
Right.
You know, so if you think about, like, you know, how you're ending a show, if it's not like, you know, a super Jerry ballad that's, you know, crushing it down like a morning dew, mm-hmm. then it should be, you know, an up-tempo, fast, you know, let's close it out with a bang before the encore.
Right.
And, you know, around, I think was, you know, late 70s, you saw it a lot, you know, closing shows. And those are ones that, you know, I was always a little disappointed that's how they ended the night.
Yeah. Now, you know, I mean, I suppose if you're there and the circumstances are right and they really nail it, then, you know, as always, I, you know, my joke with Jim always was that, you know, for us, Little Red Rooster and CC Rider were automatic pisser tunes, right? You know, okay, we'll see in a few minutes. But if you ever sat and really listened to him somewhere along the way, you know, Jerry would take over and he'd really start jamming on those songs. And they, you know, they could be a good vehicle, you know, for a couple of really good guitar solos along the way. But it was never a tune that, like, you know, got you excited. And I agree with what you say about Around and Around. And I think that that's a very apt description, that it lacks the rocking and rolling of Promised Land or some of his other tunes. You know, the one that I really like that the Garcia band used to play is the one, C'est La Vie Goes to Show You Never Can Tell.
Yeah, I agree.
And the Garcia band covered that a couple of times, and I think that's a great tune.
Oh, they played it all the time. Yeah, no, it's great. And it's so funny because that's a song that I don't think anyone really, you know, outside of, you know, an earlier generation would have really known too well, but for when Pulp Fiction came out and used that as their dance tune.
Exactly. I was just going to say, to me, it was the Pulp Fiction song.
Yeah, yeah. And when I saw Pulp, I was like, that's great. I mean, I knew C'est La Vie from seeing Garcia band shows for years. And all of a sudden it became like a popular tune among other, like, people that knew nothing about the Dead or Garcia band. Whereas I always thought of it, you know, like I never knew as a tune anything other than a Garcia band tune.
Right. Right. You know, just a lot of those, but that was great. So there you go. And of course, I suppose, you know, in a certain way, you know, those of us, you know, who are the real, you know, true Deadheads, not to say that others aren't, but certainly the ones who would, you know, go anywhere, anytime, they saved us a lot of headache and family arguments over the years. You know, that would not have gone over very well in my family year after year. Sorry, kids, I'm not going to be here with you. I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, not going to be here with you for Thanksgiving. I got to go see the Dead again. So, you know, I guess they were doing all of us a favor to some degree.
Yeah, I think that's right. I can think about how many times I'd fly home from college and get back. My mom would be like, great to see you. I'm like, I got to go. And I just pack up and take off wherever the next venue was. And, you know, never very pleased. We should be like, yeah, I would have never bought your plane ticket if I knew you were just going to get home and go on tour. I think if I were to do that on Thanksgiving, I probably would have been disowned.
Probably. Okay. And speaking of Thanksgiving, and one other topic, and I go to Thanksgiving dinner every year. And for years, it was my parents, and then it was my brothers. And now it's my brother's kids, who are all old enough to understand, you know, what I do and that I like Grateful Dead and this and that. And they'll say to me, you know, Uncle Larry, all you do is listen to the Grateful Dead. I like Taylor Swift and I can only listen to her for so long. And then I get tired of it and I don't want to listen anymore or whatever their music of choice is. And it you know, my typical answer is, I just like them. But, you know, it's really more than that because I think it's also almost too easy to say because each song is a little bit different, because even if I have, you know, five different tapes of Shakedown Street or five different CDs with it, I can listen to any of them anytime and, you know, be equally happy. And it was spontaneous. I guess what I think is it's trying to say is it still feels spontaneous, even though it's not spontaneous.
Yeah, I think that's right. And look, you already touched on it earlier when you talked about the dancing going into the Terrapin being worth the price of admission. You know, I think of all the different times I've heard both those songs, and I can't think of any other time where I can think of a set list where it goes Dancing Terrapin. And I remember, like, how excited I am to still listen to Cape Cod Coliseum from 79 because of the Dancing Franklins, you know, just having like that ripping kind of like late 70s disco dancing. So, you know, when you think about the different eras of the Dead and you think about the different ways they play it and the different transitions they do, and you know, you always think, okay, how's this going to be interpreted this time? You know, most people that don't listen to things very closely might not understand the nuances, but for those that actually really listen to the music, I think that you never get tired of it because it's always something that's fresh. And that's, for me, is part of the reason why I can listen to, you know, tape after tape, or at this point now, I guess, you know, archive after archive, and just still get excited about what they're doing. Cause I'll always find something, if it's just background music, where I go, let me rewind that for a second and listen to that again. Like I listened to the jam between the first and the second verse of Eyes of the World from 33191, I think, from Greensboro the other day. I listened to that jam 3 times in a row, because every time of the playfulness between Bruce Hornsby and Garcia, it's just so darn good that I'm like, all right, I'm going to, you know, rewind that and hear that again, because you'll never hear that jam like that again.
Well, I think that's right. And it's, I mean, for me, it speaks to me on two levels. One is if I understand, you know, and like the significance of it. I was at the show in the Garden in September of 83 when they brought back St. Stephen for the first time in 5 years, and they did a breakout. And, you know, I remember being there in the midst of all of that. And my biggest regret is I was still, you know, such a newbie in the whole scene that even though I had already seen him about 8 or 9 times, it was almost hard to really fully appreciate the moment. So now what I find is when I go back and I pull that up and I listen to it, absolutely appreciating the moment and totally loving the fact that I was there, you know, I kind of like get, you know, goosebumps that I almost couldn't have gotten the first time around, because you didn't know what was about to happen, you know. Right. And I love kind of reliving that moment over and over. And then the other thing is, you were talking about that jam between the first and second verse. You know, for me, what I find is the more that I learn about the Grateful Dead, both by reading about them, hearing about them, but also listening to them, that I can go back and listen to a show that I've listened to 100 times. And with some new information that I picked up along the way, all of a sudden it has a whole new sound to me, because now I am focused on the fact that, oh, wow, this was the first time that Hornsby and Vince were playing together. You know, I hadn't really focused on that before, you know, so you can, it's a constantly evolving scene. You know, it's never the same, because you just know more and you experience it differently each time.
Yeah, definitely. And the song selection can be completely different between eras. Like, you know, you and I think of let's say a Shakedown as only a first set opener, and sometimes, you know, rarely a second set opener. We never think about it as being something that's in the middle of the set the way it was in the 70s, because we didn't see that era. Whereas, you know, other songs, you know, that were only played during certain periods. And before I came on today, I actually was looking through, and like, being the Grateful Dead dork that I am, I've got, like, you know, all sorts of stats that are still in a 3-ring binder from the 90s that I still, you know, have carried with me every time I've moved.
Sure.
And I looked at the stats and I saw the Dead play 177 different songs. That's a lot of songs, you know. That's a massive amount. And a lot of those were songs that they only were playing for the first time in, like, you know, the mid to late mid 90s, you know, that they only played a couple times before the Dead ended. And then there's a lot that, you know, I saw in the late 80s that were getting phased out that you weren't seeing anymore. And it was rare that, you know, that I saw songs that they played all the way through, you know, an 8-year or 9-year period that I saw them. So you always have to think about, you know, what they're doing to reinvent it. You know, if you look at a song like Friend of the Devil, you know, what speed are they playing it at? Is it a fast friend or a slow friend? You know, same thing with an Eyes. Is it a fast Eyes or a slow Eyes? There's completely different tempos they've changed over the years.
And I'll tell you, my favorite is They Love Each Other. In 1973, They Love Each Other is totally upbeat. It's like a whole, it's a completely different song. So much so that, you know, hearing it automatically takes me to that time period. And it's just, you know, it's incredible. I really, really love the way they do it and love the way they play it then. But, you know, look, that it was for a brief period, and he doesn't play it that way anymore. They didn't play it that way anymore, and that's okay, because it's just, but it's fun. You know, I can be listening on the radio and they Love Each Other comes on, and that's that speed up version. I'll turn to my kids and say, oh, that's 1973. How did you know that?
Yeah. Well, I think 73 has so many nuances like that. The China Rider, a transition jam, is like that too, where it never has the that whole part is gone in the 73 one. And it's just a much more fluid transition.
Yep.
And then, you know, obviously the Weather Report suites from 73, you know, it's so recognizable. As soon as you hear the opening notes to the beginning of it, you're like, okay, that's a 73 Weather Report.
Well, and I just, as long as you mentioned Weather Report, I love Bob Weir, and I realize he's always been an integral part of the Grateful Dead. I was always a Jerry guy. Bobby was a great sideman to him, and it worked out just well for me. And I love seeing Bobby now, but I don't like the fact that Bobby focuses on Jerry's tunes quite as much as he does, because he likes to play them his way. And I'm like, would you just fucking play Weather Report, Sweet, for God's sakes? Play it. It's such a great song. Why do you feel compelled to play all this Garcia stuff when you're sitting on some great tunes? Play them.
I never understood why they shelved that one. Of all the things, you know, of all the things to shelve, Weather Report was high on my list of why'd you get rid of it. Passenger, they eventually brought back, but that was another one that was such a high energy that I'm like, why'd you shelve that one for so long?
And Viola Lee Blues, three lines of lyrics and 20 minutes of amazing music. I love Viola Lee Blues.
Supplication too, you know, like why'd you shelve Supplication?
Yep.
Yeah.
These were all great. So I guess that's the short answer, is because otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here, you know, week after week talking about the Grateful Dead and still be just as excited as the first time we've done it.
Yeah. No, I think once you're hooked, then there's an endless amount of music to listen to. And I think there's one thing that band did so well was that they encouraged the taping. And because of that, for the rest of our lives, we'll still never listen to all of it. You know, even if I get a chance to go through the entire catalog, there's no way I can like pay attention to all of it without listening to it a second, third, fourth, fifth time.
Well, right. So I was going to say, there's always this talk about people have these hard drives or whatever that supposedly have the entire
terabyte. Yeah, I have it.
A friend of mine was telling me he's like, don't buy the CDs. I'm like, I buy the CDs because I'm a sucker. I love the packaging. I love the stories. I love all of it. I just buy it and I have it. But even with all my CDs, at the beginning of this year, I sat down and I organized them chronologically by calendar day to see if I would always have at least one concert per day in my collection to listen to. And I didn't quite, but I caught a lot of days, and some days I had multiple shows to listen to from over the years, you know, that were all played on the same date, but you know, it was pretty good. I was able, and I realized how often, what is there, 2000 plus shows. You're right. Even if you sat down and listened, you're talking at least 4 or 5 years just to get through the shows. But how do you appreciate them if you don't listen to each show 3 or 4 times?
Mine for the day is a 3 1978 Garcia band from the Stanley Theater.
Oh, okay. That's a great one. I've been listening very heavily, and I know you mentioned this to me after you were last on our show, this last Dave's Picks 37. I really, really like that. That's been the one in my car that I've been going to, or 36, I should say, that I've been going to pretty much nonstop since it came out.
As I said, the second night first set is one of the most high energy first sets I've ever, it's from top to bottom. That whole show almost is a high energy, both sets, like very, very, like Tennessee Jed might be the slowest thing on the entire two discs, but it's, rare you see him hard charging all the way through like that.
Did you ever see them at Hartford?
Yeah, I did. I saw the Dead in Hartford in 1990 when they announced them just days before the show, the way the Warlocks was in Hampton.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they didn't announce it until about 6 days before. I had to drive back and forth from New York up to Hartford because they were only selling tickets in Connecticut. We went every single day once the rumors were hitting that they were going to release them any day. And I drove, I think, three mornings in a row at like 5 a.m. before school to go up and get those tickets. So I saw those two nights, and I saw a Garcia band play at Hartford Civic Center as well in 89 with Clarence Clemens, which was a 9/5/89 great night. So did see three shows there. I'll say Hartford was such a cool venue because it was attached to the shopping mall. So it was like where the Hartford Whalers played. Uh-huh. So literally you could walk out of Payless shoes and walk into the venue. I can't think of any other place that was like that. It was just such a strange, strange scene.
Well, I'll tell you, that's actually very funny. I like that because we saw them at in Hamilton, Ontario, right outside of Toronto. There's a big amusement park up there. And literally you pay to get into the amusement park and then you pay extra to have a ticket. And when it's time, you walk in like a special, normally you go to Six Flags and they've got the Greg Kinn band or somebody playing, but now all of a sudden it was like the Grateful Dead playing, and you had Deadheads on the roller coasters and on the Ferris wheels, and then stumbling into this concert and afterwards stumbling back out into the amusement park, which had closed by that time, but try getting the Deadheads out of there.
The only time I saw him there was in March of 1992. It was in the middle of a freezing cold snap in Hamilton. So it wasn't that great time to be riding roller coasters.
Yep.
But, you know, compared to the next year, you know, I made reference in our emails earlier today of the 93 spring tour, where basically it was blizzarding the entire time from Chicago through Richfield, Ohio.
Yep.
And that's, you know, I've only went to two shows that were canceled the night of the show. That was one of them, in Deer Creek in 95 was the other. But the Cleveland show canceled for, what, 3 feet of snow, which turned into probably one of the greatest parties I've ever been to the Holiday Inn. Yeah, at the Holiday Inn.
I wasn't there, but I've heard stories about that.
Legendary. I mean, it's literally like, you know, every single person that would have been in the lot, you know, like, that would have been setting up shop there, was instead inside this hotel, and the hotel said, everyone can come and we're not going to kick anyone out. And they actually found blankets for everyone and let people sleep in the hallways. But they kept the bar open all night because they knew the cops couldn't get to the hotel. And it was just absolute insanity in that place. It was great.
In the spring of 89, I saw the Dead in Milwaukee. And same thing, the Bradley Center was basically attached to this multi-level store hotel that had a big, huge atrium in the middle. And all the floors had balconies overlooking the atrium. And we were staying in there. And after the show, there were Deadheads filling up. They had no other place to stay, so they all came in. They were crashing in the hallways, and then, you know, somebody would like start banging on the side, and they'd all get, you had this entire, you know, 20 stories of Deadheads banging on the side and creating this. It was unlike anything I had ever seen. It was, yeah, we had a good time.
And that's saying a lot, because there's a lot of raucous nights in hotels I've had during Dead tour where, you know, it was
a lot of raucous
nights. They didn't know what hit them, but then there's a couple ones that stand out where, you know, the stars aligned and all of a sudden 50,000 people would end up at the same hotel.
Right. And, exactly. You know, and if you were lucky, the Dead might be there too.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of 95, I had the tip off somewhere they were staying and ended up in the same hotel as the band for a bunch of those nights. But those actually were a lot more tame, because there's a lot of, you know, close friends and road crew and everyone else that would be at those hotels. But other nights where, you know, you're kind of on your own. Yeah. I can certainly think of probably a handful of like 8 or 10 hotels where they're, in retrospect, probably very happy to have seen us go.
Well, these sound like fascinating stories, which just means we'll have to have you back either as another host along with me or with Jim, or certainly as a guest, and we'll get you up into the three-timers club there.
That's the thing. I'm looking, Larry, I want the green jacket, you know, the way they hand out Saturday Night Live after the fifth time. So at a certain point, you know what?
We're going to have to talk to Dan Humiston about that. He's in charge of wardrobe, so hopefully he'll pull that together for us. And speaking of Dan Humiston, I always like to give him credit, but even today, because when Rob and I get together, we do have a tendency to just keep talking. And I noticed that we've gone way past our normal time. And I know that at the beginning, Dan told us that he had some family plans that he wanted to get to. So we're going to do him the favor and we can take our conversation offline. But it's always a pleasure, Rob. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Larry, and have a really lovely Thanksgiving, a safe Thanksgiving to you and your family, and Dan, the producer, as well. Dan, thanks for having us, and, you know, everyone out there, please have a safe, happy, quiet Thanksgiving this year.
Absolutely. So, everyone, thank you for listening. We'll look forward to hearing you next week. Jim Marty should be back with me. Have a great Thanksgiving. Listen to some Grateful Dead and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thank you very much.